Welcome to the second episode in our CME podcast series on demystifying fiber in pediatric patients. The series is sponsored by the NASPGHAN Foundation for Children's Digestive Health and Nutrition, along with the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, and in collaboration with the American Academy of Pediatrics. A very special thank you to Procter & Gamble for providing support for this educational activity. I'm Dr. Ian Scheinman, Chair of the NASPGHAN Nutrition Committee and NASPGHAN Foundation Nutrition Campaign, and Associate Professor of Pediatrics, Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. This podcast focuses on the role of dietary fiber in common GI diseases in pediatric patients. Our faculty today is Dr. Mark Corkins, who is the Division Chief of Pediatric Gastroenterology at Les Bonheur Children's Hospital and Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Tennessee Health Sciences Center in Memphis, Tennessee, along with Dr. Asim McGool, who is an Assistant Professor of Clinical Pediatric and Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine.
Hi, this is Asim McBool, and along with Mark Corkins, we're going to talk to you about dietary fiber today in a more detailed way. We're going to talk to you about the role of fiber in common pediatric diseases. This podcast is brought to you by the NASPGHAN Foundation and by NASPGHAN. And I think we're going to start with reviewing what is fiber, and let's go over the basics. So, Mark, what is fiber? How do we think about fiber?
Well, fiber, the easiest definition is non-digestible carbohydrates, but we've thought of them traditionally as soluble and insoluble, but that's changed. And now we think about functional and digestible and fermentable. And basically, there's a multiple types. The most important thing, really, is the total, is the dietary plus the functional. The recommendation is age plus 5 with a max of 25 per the American Health Foundation.
Okay. So we sort of have moved from thinking about fiber from a traditional way into a sort of a more meaningful way, and we sort of know how much we're supposed to be taking in to help with certain diseases. So I guess we should talk about certain diseases, and we can talk about these diseases in terms of conditions that are associated with not having too much fiber, in terms of how they present, what some of the possible mechanisms could be, and what role fiber plays in management of these conditions. And then we can talk about conditions associated with too much fiber. There is such a thing as too much fiber, unfortunately, and sort of how fiber helps risk reduction for chronic non-communicable diseases, because after all, that's what pediatrics is all about, risk reduction for chronic diseases. And then we can sort of wrap up. So, Mark, what kind of diseases should we talk about today?
Well, the first and most obvious, and what most pediatric GI doctors think about first, is constipation. And there are studies that show that constipated children have a lower fiber intake. There's one treatment study using a soluble fiber, and it showed improved stool output. There's one study in special needs children that usually have a low fiber intake. These kids were already on a softener. They increased their fiber intake, and they found that they could decrease the softener dose. These guys really worked to bulking agents, and they help improve the stool hydration. So constipation is obviously, again, a place where fiber is probably a part of the whole process, and it's probably inadequate fiber intake as part of the process that leads to constipation. What about inflammatory bowel diseases, Asim?
So inflammatory bowel diseases are very interesting. In terms of risk for acquiring IBD, there have been a number of epidemiological studies that have shown that when populations move from their traditional diets to the modern Western diet, the incidence of IBD goes up, and some of that may relate to decreases in butyric acid that are generated by fermentation of these fibers in the colon by the microbiota, and decreased levels of butyric acid, for example, have been associated with the risk for developing ulcerative colitis. So there may be a epidemiological role there. And in certain forms of IBD, such as Crohn's disease, we generally have to modify the kind of fiber intake we put in because we want to decrease the mechanical roughage aspects of fiber. So we may avoid raw vegetables, for example, or nuts, at least early in the course of the disease, and later on that can sort of be reexamined. So that's sort of how inflammatory bowel disease and fiber tie together. How about things like short bowel syndrome? Mark, what do you know about fiber and short bowel syndrome?
Well, it's an interesting condition in short bowel because it's a therapy. There's lots of abstracts, lots of reports, but not any huge studies. And so a lot of this is the way we manage it is very stylistic. Most commonly, people use pectin, a soluble type fiber, and it seems to, again, slow down transit time, may help absorption. Does having a colon help? It may make a difference because the short-chain fatty acids come from the fermentable fibers, and that's an energy source for the colon. So, again, in those cases, it seems to help with some of the adaptation and the function of the colon. Short bowel kids, it's very much every patient is different, and it's every situation is tailor-made for that patient individually. But certainly fiber is helpful in short bowel patients in the right environment.
Right. Fiber is the, or the short-chain fatty acids, rather, are the preferred food or a substrate, energy substrate for the colon. And the colon is important in protein and energy metabolism much more than we used to think about.
Yeah.
So other things that sort of fiber can be challenging in or sort of fascinating in are diseases like celiac disease. Now, the risk for developing celiac disease seems to be if, in terms of when fiber is introduced. If it's introduced before 4 months of age or after 7 months of age, you may have increased risk for development of celiac disease. So the question of when it's introduced, I think, is very critical in the sort of environmental risk factor for this disease. But, Mark, what do we do about kids with celiac disease in terms of how do we get around the issue of gluten sensitivity or not being able to give them some of the more common fibers in our diet, the oats, the rye, the barley, and the wheat? How do we get around that?
Well, basically, then you have to look at plant sources that are not wheat, rye, or barley based. And this takes some real creativity. And there are sources available, but sometimes it takes a little bit of some work and a little searching for fiber sources to get them an adequate fiber intake. What about the ketogenic diet? Now, those are a very, very interesting subset of patients.
Right, and those children often run into issues with either very loose stools or very hard stools, again, because of not having enough mechanical roughage in their diet related to strictly avoiding carbohydrates. But One of the interesting aspects of dietary fiber is it's a non-digestible carbohydrate, so it may lend itself very well to this condition in which we can use fibers like pectin, for example, which we do clinically very frequently to help get that stool right in the right kind of range, not too hard, not too soft. The sort of the kind of fiber that they didn't talk about in Goldilocks and the Three Bears, but you got to get it just right to get that right consistency of stool.
Absolutely. Of course, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about prevention. You know, in pediatrics, we love prevention. And one of the things that fiber does is it leads to satiety. It slows emptying. Foods that are high in fiber are less energy dense. Well, this is a very obvious place where this would be helpful in obesity. It possibly reduces the risk of insulin resistance and diabetes as well. So I don't know of a lot of literature, but it seems very logical that obesity be a great place to have an increased fiber intake. Other things, prevention-wise, some.
I think that's great. With obesity, it certainly probably has a role both in the prevention and hopefully in the management. Colon cancer is another one in which, you know, fiber may reduce the risk of colon cancer. Again, by decreasing transit time, it may dilute and bind toxins. And again, the short-chain fatty acids that it may generate may, again, provide some benefit. The precise mechanisms I don't think we know as well. We do know, however, from epidemiological studies that dietary fiber intake does reduce the risk for development of colon cancer. Yeah.
Another area is fortified cereals.
Yeah, and I think that's a very underreported but important success story. How have we used fortified cereals to reduce risk of a chronic disease that we don't think about with fiber?
Well, those are great sources of folic acid. And that's a very successful strategy that has been shown to reduce the incidence of neural tube defects. So, again, that's a great intervention with fiber. Now, the mechanism of action theories, what are the theories you hold with, Assam?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the brain, the kidneys, the heart, they use glucose as the preferred substrate, whereas the colon, the preferred substrate is short-chain fatty acids, and these are what sort of the dynamic milieu in the colon where the microbiota sort of interact. They generate these short-chain fatty acids, which provide fuel for the colon. They may reduce risk of dysplasia. They may have some cross-interaction. There may be a symbiosis occurring. And they may also balance this very well-orchestrated immune and inflammatory response in the colon. And those are some of the thoughts in how fiber really helps reduce risk for inflammatory conditions or dysplastic conditions in the colon. And as I mentioned before, when you sort of move from traditional diets to the modern Western diet, which is not as high in fiber, which has more processed foods and different carbohydrates in it, those we can sort of see that those risk profiles change.
So Mark, the next question.
Go ahead.
One of the questions always is there anything about too much fiber? Is there any worry there? Yeah, because there's some concerns about interaction with the micronutrients, for instance, calcium. There's some reports of increased fecal excretion of calcium, but the human studies don't seem to indicate it's an issue. Magnesium, again, no effect based on the studies. Iron, fiber in theory reduces absorption, but we may need to increase iron stores, but the studies cite that phytate is the problem, but others don't. Zinc, the phytate should be able to bind zinc, but most human studies haven't shown an adverse effect on absorption. So there's lots of concerns. There's some theoretical concerns, but most of the studies indicate that when you actually look at it in practice, it doesn't play out. And this is supposed to be a part of our diet. We're designed to have fiber in our diet.
Yes, that's right. We also don't we talk about fiber also not only for constipation, but for something that affects one in five Americans, which is sort of irritable bowel syndrome or more of the functional abdominal complaints that we often see. And one of them that we talk about frequently is gas and bloating and diarrhea. For example, broccoli has been linked implicated as a cause of these, and sometimes you have to substitute one fiber out for another. Gluten sensitivity is another one. You may not have full-blown celiac disease, but there's a population out there that is sensitive to gluten. And you can live without gluten. You can have substitutions of different kinds of fibers, but you have to make sure that you have the right balance of nutrients sort of in the system. Mark, could you talk a little bit about irritable bowel syndrome and this new diet that I've heard about called FODMAPs? What is FODMAPs, and how does fiber play into the whole FODMAPs diet?
Well, obviously FODMAPs is an acronym. Fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. Lactose and fructose are the most often cited. These people are really sensitive to certain kinds of dietary constituents, including fiber, and basically certain foods will lead to more abdominal pain, gas, and bloating. Certain fruits are more common with this, certain vegetables. Again, kind of going back to the broccoli idea. And so these folks are extremely sensitive, and they may do better on a low FODMAP foods. And so there's a current move in the folks with irritable bowel syndrome to recommend a low FODMAP diet, fruits such as bananas, vegetables such as carrots and celery and corn, being careful with our artificial sweeteners, and also being very cautious with lactose and lactose intake. Although they're not exactly lactose intolerant, they seem to have difficulty with those kind of fermentable products.
So basically what you're saying is we're swapping out certain kinds of fibers for other kinds of fibers in this condition. We're not necessarily eliminating as much as we're substituting as a strategy to help incrementally improve these symptoms in the sometimes very challenging patients.
Absolutely. Again, this is very cutting edge, and more of this will be coming along as more studies are done. So trying to put all this together, today we've talked about a variety of different diseases. The first and most obvious is, again, constipation, where obviously we need to have an adequate fiber intake to ensure that we have a regular stool output. The inflammatory bowel diseases, where early on it may be an issue, but on the other hand, the lack of fiber may be part of the etiology of developing the disease. There's diseases like celiac disease and gluten sensitivity where we have to be very careful and may have to substitute our fibers. we actually have some things where fiber may be helpful in preventing disease, such as obesity and colon cancer. And then the new information about the FODMAPs and the different kinds of fibers that may actually contribute to some of the symptoms of the new irritable bowel syndrome. But we have come to the end of our time, and I've appreciated your attention.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode in the CME podcast series on demystifying fiber in pediatric patients. Please go to the NASPGINFoundation.org to the Nutrition and Obesity section to receive future episodes. I'm Ann Scheiman.